Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And Bob is thankfully filling in for Dr. Adam Goldstein today. We're glad to have you with us, Bob.
I'm pleased to be here again.
On our show today, Bob, we get to talk with Dr. Kevin Bice of the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine about geriatric emergency medicine. And I know, Bob, you agree that as our population ages, it's so important for us to think about the experiences of our geriatric patients in the emergency department and how we can improve the care in that setting.
And I'm really looking forward to hearing what Kevin has to say. But first, we're going to talk about research that matters.
We've got some good ones. We were talking about vision surgery and dry eyes, about the safety of flu shot in pregnancy, a little bit about sleep with blue light or not, and salt intake in kids.
So let's talk about this vision with surgery first and some of the side effects it has. I know you've had some eye surgery. Tell us what your experience was.
Well, I did have LASIK surgery. My husband also did by a strange coincidence that turned out well for both of us. I haven't had any problems with dry eyes, and his is too early to say, but we sure have been pleased and grateful that we were able to have that done.
My son had 8 diopter corrections, which is very, very nearsighted, and now is able to function without glasses, which is really amazing. This surgery was really, this article is a little different, though, because what they did was they talked about 2 different procedures for doing these vision corrections. One of them, LASIK, the more common, which is about 85% of the surgeries that get done, and a lesser known one called PRK, which stands for photorefractive keratectomy.
And they were trying to figure out if there's a difference in dry eyes as a result of the procedure with the PRK versus the LASIK, because a lot of times they say, oh, the PRK is better or it has less chance of dry eyes. So they studied it.
And they did a really interesting study because they took some people, not a huge number, but 37, I think was what it was, and they did one eye with LASIK and one eye with PRK, and then they had them tell them what their symptoms and side effects from the surgery were. And it turned out that there was no difference in this dry eye symptom that some people get after either surgery. And so they can't really say that PRK, which is thought perhaps in theory to caused less of that, but it didn't, in fact.
So I think the take-home message there is if you're going to get vision surgery, do ask about dry eyes. And if they're promoting this PRK, which is more expensive just for that benefit, you might want to ask more questions about that because there's really no difference, at least in this study. Let's do our next one. And this is about the importance and the safety of flu shot in early pregnancy.
So for quite a while, all the organizations of physicians and public health have been advocating women getting a flu shot during a pregnancy. And the reason behind this really is that women's autoimmune system is somewhat shut down a little bit during pregnancy so that they don't reject their child. And so it is true that women who do actually get influenza during a pregnancy have some higher incidence of the worst outcomes, like pneumonia. And so this recommendation was made, let's give all pregnant women flu shots. Well, then the question was, are you going to have a negative effect on the baby? And that's what this study's about.
So they looked at 9,000 pregnant women who got the flu shot and followed them out to see what happened with them and the safety of their baby compared with people who did not get the vaccine.
And they actually proved that while some people who got the flu shot did have kids with birth defects, so did most of the women who didn't have a higher percentage of them. And there was actually a lower percentage of birth defects among the women who got the flu shot.
So the bottom line is that pregnant women can get really sick from the flu, sicker than if you're not pregnant. And this study is one more piece that adds to the safety data of getting that flu shot and certainly benefits women to reduce that risk of harm. So if you are pregnant or know someone who's pregnant, please encourage them to get that flu shot without fear.
The next article we've got is about blue lights helping people go to sleep. And we haven't got a study yet on this, but there is quite a marketing effort going on to sell either little contraptions that will shine blue lights on your ceiling or cause a blue light to be in a mask you put over your eyes, and even a cell phone app for this. And the notion is that a lot of people find blue to be a soothing, restful color. And if they can lie awake instead of counting sheep and look at the blue light on the ceiling, maybe they'll go to sleep faster.
There's also some theory to suggest that the blue light may decrease levels of melatonin in your body, which is something that helps you sleep in its natural rhythm and cycle. So there's some disagreement about whether or not this is a good thing. And honestly, there's really no data to support it either way. So, I mean, I think if you've got some blue lights and you want to try painting your room blue and looking at blue, that to me is very calming because it's my favorite color. But it's probably not something that support. It's definitely not something supported by any sort of evidence.
And the last article really is about salt intake in kids in the United States. And it's true that kids eat a lot of salt in this country. And actually, the adult recommended amount of salt to take in is 2,300 milligrams. And on average, a very large study of children showed that our kids average 3,387 milligrams, higher than the recommended intake and almost as high as their adults consume in this country.
And the children who consumed more salt were at higher risk of having high blood pressure. This is also complicated because, as you know, Bob, we've got a real problem, a real epidemic of obesity in children in our country. And we know that overweight children, obese children, are more likely to develop high blood pressure as adolescents. I've got multiple teenage patients, young children who have high blood pressure as a result of their weight. And this sort of adds in another component of salt in the diet.
And a finding in the study was actually those kids who were overweight or obese tended to have more elevation of their blood pressures than the kids who weren't, which is kind of sad. You know, when I thought about this, I thought, well, kids eat a lot of potato chips and peanuts and, you know, corn chips and stuff that have salt all over them. But it turns out the biggest intake of salt in kids was bread.
Huh, that is interesting. And it's certainly going to make me reflect on how much salty foods I give my children. I think the real take-home point is for us to pay attention to the salt intake, but also to put a real emphasis on healthy nutrition and physical activity, and make sure you talk with your doctor at the Well Child Check of, is your child at a healthy weight? Thank you for some good conversations about research that matters, Bob. We talked about salt intake in kids. We talked about blue light and not a lot of evidence for that.
And we talked about LASIK and the fact that it seems to be a very successful thing and doesn't cause dry eyes any more than the other available surgeries for vision.
And we also talked about the safety of flu shot in early pregnancy. So we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Kevin Bice from the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine about geriatric emergency medicine and the care of older adults in that setting. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Bob Gwyther, our guest host, and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care and research to participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health. Today on Conversations, my guest host, Dr. Bob Gwyther, and I will be talking with Dr. Kevin Bice of the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine about geriatric emergency medicine. And we are certainly fortunate to have Dr. Bice with us today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Dr. Bice, I'm curious how you got interested in the care of older adults in the emergency department.
Yeah, I appreciate that question, Bob. It's interesting to me that I just graduated from residency 6 years ago. And when I was in training in Boston, geriatric emergency medicine, or the specialized care of older patients in the emergency department, wasn't even really on the menu. We were aware that children needed different types of care in the emergency department, but there wasn't a special curriculum for older adults. And paying attention in the emergency department when I was in training, it became obvious that maybe there should be. If you'll allow me one short story, I was leaving the hospital one night, and it was a busy day, and I was in the part of the ED where all the gunshots and the heart attacks and all that stuff would come. And I was walking out of the hospital, and there was, in the emergency department, there was this nice old lady lying on a corner, in the corner, on a cot. And I thought, well, geez, that can't be good. I don't know tons about caring for older patients, but she shouldn't be in a corner on a cot. I wish I could tell you I did something about it right then. I didn't. I went home. But I came back 12 hours later, same lady, same cot, same corner, no good. And so we started some initiatives up there about at least getting real hospital beds for patients, trying to get them into rooms, and the rest is kind of continued from there.
Physical plants are not built with this in mind, are they? So you must have thought about some of the requirements.
Absolutely. In fact, there's been some people writing about it. There's a group of about 25 physicians in emergency medicine around the country, and it's growing. It's probably 100 in total, but 25 sort of passionate leaders in the group that have been looking at this. And so Eula Wong in the late 2007 or 8 wrote an article on what if emergency department for older patients should look like. And so, you know, some places have been redesigned with that in mind. You want to think about the flooring. You want to think about the lights. You want to think about dimming the lights in the middle of the night so people can get some sleep if they still have to be in the emergency department. You want to think about clocks and date reminders. So absolutely, I think that if we think about taking better care of at-risk older patients, we need to think about their surroundings.
Well, let's talk a little bit further about that and the why. When we think about what's different caring for children versus adults, you can think about some common things, that they're with their parent who's supervising them, and different aspects of caring for children. When we think about caring for older adults in that emergency setting compared with younger adults, what are the main differences that come out as you think about taking care of people?
I think they can be divided up into a couple categories. One is communication. I mean, as you just mentioned, we all know that if you bring, you know, I have three children, and if I bring my three-year-old to the emergency department, it's assumed that I'm going to help her navigate that space and help, you know, the physicians understand what's going on with her, that it wouldn't work otherwise. Well, in our patients at UNC that are 75 years of age and older that present to the emergency department, 40% of them don't give their own chief complaint. Meaning many of our older patients have some level of cognitive decline or for whatever reason are unable to communicate as well themselves, and they're relying upon loved one and proxies to communicate for them, and there's some analogies there in that sign of communication. Also, the physiology of older patients is different. They don't have the same complaints necessarily. They don't always have the exact same pain manifestations that tell us exactly what's going on with them. And they also are, many of them are on lots of medications that mask what we might typically think are going to cause, you know, if you have a heart attack, you should have chest pain. Well, in North Carolina, 50% of our patients that have very bad heart attacks over ST elevation MIs don't come with a chief complaint of chest pain. Sometimes we look for things like blood pressure or heart rate to tell us what's going on with patients, but these patients might be on medications that are changing their blood pressure or heart rates. So for physiological reasons and communication reasons, there are some real differences between caring for older adults and younger adults.
Well, I would imagine in the communication piece that it's hard for an older adult who may have either difficulty speaking or understanding what's happening, or may be afraid to be able to advocate for themselves. And I know, Bob, you agree, but Adam and I talk a lot about this on the show, of how important it is for you and your caregiver to advocate for you so everybody's sure that we know what's going on.
Absolutely, Christy. I think seeing a doctor, and there's three of us at this table, I think seeing a doctor in general can be a little anxiety provoking. And although we try and do everything we can in the emergency department to not make it more anxiety provoking, it probably is. Most people who come to the emergency department did not intend to come there that day. Something has happened that they didn't want or expect to happen that has precipitated that visit. And then there they are in a new environment and lots of people asking lots of questions. I think it can be intimidating for everyone. I think that if you do have any cognitive decline, and most older patients don't have cognitive decline, but some do.
And you're talking about problems with memory or thinking.
Absolutely. So, you know, dementia or even just more minor cognitive thinking. And again, most older patients don't have problems with cognitive decline, but certainly are very elderly. Are at risk of some thinking process problems. If you have any of that and you show up in the emergency department, it must be a very intimidating and overwhelming experience. So if patients in that situation may not be great communicators at baseline, and it may be even harder for them to get out what's going on and what they're thinking about when they show up.
Another thing that I wanted to ask you, I know on our inpatient service, and every hospitalized patient has to tell the physicians at the time they get admitted whether or not they would want to be resuscitated if something was to happen in the hospital so that their heart stopped beating or whatever. And in your shoes, especially with older folks, having a cardiac arrest or a respiratory arrest is probably not an uncommon phenomenon, and yet you don't have that time to prep on the way in to the emergency room because they roll right in off an ambulance or out of their kid's back car seat or whatever.
I think that's a great question, Bob, and I'm glad you asked it. It kind of follows up nicely on Christy's comment about advocating for your loved one. You know, one of the most important things all of us can do, myself included, is make sure that we talk to the people in our lives about what they would like to have happen if and when all of us are in that situation someday. There are forms. There are, you know, do not resuscitate and do not initiate intubation forms that can come with patients. And even without those forms, our hope is that for most people that arrive in the emergency department, there'll be someone that is able to communicate with us their understanding of what their loved one would like to have happen in that situation. When we don't know at all, we're always going to do everything we can to save that person as far as it seems appropriate and possible. But if we can handle that situation in the way the patient would like, that would be our preferred avenue.
And what are the best steps for people in thinking about preparing for that day? So talking to a loved one about their wishes for that and talking to their primary care provider is a big piece of that. But in terms of coming to the emergency department, what kinds of things should people do to prepare for that unexpected trip?
Absolutely. I think there are some really practical steps all of us can take and that are perhaps even more important for older patients coming to the emergency department. One is you should always have a list of medications with you at all times. And when you come, either bring that list or bring those medications. Also, I'm glad, Christy, you mentioned primary care provider. It's perhaps more important than ever that we realize that doctors don't work in silos. We should work together. So if you can bring along the contact information for your primary care physician, that'll help me and us, the emergency medicine physicians, contact them and make sure we work in concert to get the goals of care that would be best for you. I think also very practically, many of our older patients have hearing or visual impairments. And if you can bring glasses or hearing aids or other comfort items for that older patient, there's actually studies that show that they're less likely to get acutely confused or delirious if you can correct for those things. So those can be really helpful as well. Those are some practical advice along that line.
That's really helpful, Dr. Bice. We need to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Kevin Bice from the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine, about geriatric emergency medicine. We'll be right back with Your Health. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and my guest host today, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We've been talking with Dr. Kevin Bice of the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine about geriatric emergency medicine and some of the differences in the care of older adults in the emergency department. And Dr. Bice, before the break, you were giving our listeners some really good tips about bringing medication lists to, or keeping that with them, or their bottles themselves, about having a primary care doctor that knows a person's wishes, and about bringing glasses and hearing aids. Really helpful tips.
You know, Dr. Bice, it brought to mind an 89-year-old friend of my family who's very close, who lives in Florida, who has some bad back pain and has some chronic Vicodin that he takes for that. And he was out washing his car, slipped and fell, banged his head, and had a laceration. And he went into the emergency room, got that sewed up, and somebody gave him some Percocet to go home with to take in case he had pain. Well, he didn't realize that he shouldn't take that with Vicodin at the same time, and wound up had somebody make a call, and he wasn't arousable in his room, and they had to call the EMS, and they gave him some Narcan, and everything turned out all right. But it really is a challenge, it would seem to me, for you guys to deal with all these multiple medicine lists. I'm ashamed to say there's probably a dozen patients I took care of who had 20 medicines in their list, and that's frightening when you really think about it.
Thanks, Bob. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, I am. It's hugely important that as emergency medicine physicians, we review the medications carefully and communicate well with our patients. You know, I'm going to give you this, so you might not want to take that, or you want to modify your approach to that. And the only way we can do that is if you bring your medication lists, and if your loved one or if you have a family member that's slightly older, and I don't know about your friend who may not think of all of that, coming and staying with them is incredibly important as well. Having said that, it's still the doctor's responsibility to think about this and make sure that you kind of plan ahead as you decide what medications you're going to give and suggest.
So, Dr. Bice, we've established a little bit about the different experience that an older adult may have in the emergency department compared with a younger adult, changes in the way their body reacts and sensory. We didn't talk as much about this, but with all the different bells and whistles and things going off and lights, and I mean, it's really must be a different experience. But really, my question is, where do we go next? So we know it's a problem. That lady in the hall that you talked about, that's unacceptable. What do we do?
So many different things. I think that, you know, I'm an educator in medicine first and foremost, and so I get to run the residency training program here for our emergency medicine department and teach medical students. And I think there's an awareness of the needs of our older patients that didn't exist just a few years ago. You know, we've created curriculum to help train doctors that's being used around the country. We've built in questions on the care of older patients into the tests that doctors have to take in order to become practicing physicians. And we've created geriatric emergency medicine fellowships.
And you started your own geriatrics emergency fellowship, didn't you?
We did. We have the third active one in the country here at UNC. We have our first fellow right now. She was one of our chief residents last year. And my hope is that as we continue to train physicians with expertise in geriatrics, that they'll be able to convey to the people they go out and work with some of these new awarenesses and skills and training. Education is only one part of it, though. I think that we also need to work closely with hospital administration, and the administration at UNC has been very supportive in helping think about how we design the space, work with closely with our nursing colleagues to help think about a multidisciplinary approach to our older patients, and really think about the system of care that we're delivering for our older patients, because it has to be the approach to the older patient has to be incorporated all the way from the time they hit that front door all the way through when they're on to their next stop and their care experience. And the space is really important in that, too, as we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I'd love to understand a little bit more about the space. I understand this is starting to gain more national recognition with other emergency departments in the country starting to recognize that as our population is aging, this is going to be an even more important issue. But what when you talk about changing the space, what are the kinds of things and why? You mentioned clocks and space, but I'd love to have a visual picture of that.
Absolutely. So I think there's a lot of things. First and foremost, it's to help decrease confusion. Older patients, there are studies that show that 7 to 10% of older adults that come to emergency departments across the country get delirious, which is indicative of severe confusion and often suggestive of a significant underlying problem, an infection, a heart attack, medication misuse, something along those lines. But 7 to 10%, one out of every 10 patients we're taking care of. And those patients are at more risk of death, and they stay longer in the hospital, and they've got real problems. And the space contributes to that. We in this field are convinced the space contributes to that because it is a crazy, confusing place to be in the hallway of an emergency department on Friday night or any other time. So things you can do. One, you want to have a quieter space. Two, you have a separate door when possible. Two, you want to have space for the loved ones to come along. We strongly suggest if you have an older patient coming to the emergency department, come with them. But then the department should have space for your loved one to be with them when you're there. You need to have a space that changes the lighting a little bit day to night. It's very clear that older people and all people get more confused when there isn't a recognition of daily patterns and diurnal patterns, you know, day to night time. You want to have space that is less likely to cause injury. So you want to have no slip flooring. You want to make sure that the rails and stuff on the beds function properly, but are not prohibitive so that older patients, even if they're less able to get up and get out on their own, can still use the restroom, can still get the meals that they need. And you want to think about nursing staff and nursing assistant staff in those spaces so that, again, patients, sometimes older patients aren't quite as functional on their own, and you want to make sure that you can get them regular meals and that you can use the restroom and that you can help them in any way you can. All of those things have to be built in. And I believe strongly that not only is it the right thing to do, we have to do it because I think it'll help some of our patients who don't have to be admitted to the hospital be able to go home because we certainly don't want to be causing harm in the hospital setting.
Dr. Bice, you mentioned that you've started up a fellowship in geriatric emergency medicine. I'm curious what it is how long that takes and what do you try to give them that you don't give your residents to make them expert in this area?
It's a great question. So there are two different models for geriatric emergency medicine fellowships. Ours is currently 1 year, but can be expanded to 2 years for additional education and study of the resident to do research, really. The one-year model is clinically based. They spend some time in the emergency department, but what they really do that's different is they visit local nursing homes, local assisted living facilities. They spend time on the palliative care service. They spend time on the geriatrics inpatient service. They spend time in hospice settings. And the hope and plan is that they end up having an expertise that extends beyond the walls of the emergency department to know how to integrate the care that we're already giving in the emergency department with the rest of the community so that we can make sure patients are admitted to the hospital in the best state or sent home and all the services that can be supplied to them at home are able to be at home. And also so that as they go on all these services, the experts on that service, the geriatric psychiatrists, the geriatricians, can teach them additional knowledge about the care of older patients that they hadn't picked up in their residency.
It sounds like a team approach is important, both in training. You talked about working with geriatrics, and I know the Division of Geriatrics has been very supportive in this process for you guys, but also the team-based approach with nursing care and I'm sure social workers and case managers. You've done some work in outreach to try to make a difference for older patients. Give us a quick bottom line about what that showed.
Absolutely. So with the support of Jan Busby-Whitehead and Steve Kaiser and others in the Division of Geriatrics, we've collaborated together for 5 or 6 years and really redesigned some of our care processes for older patients. For example, we just finished a study that showed that if a nurse trained in geriatrics called older patients sent home from the emergency department within 3 days of going home, those patients were almost twice as likely to see their doctor within 5 days. And also, there's some indication they were less likely to come back to the emergency department or be readmitted to the hospital within 35 days. There are some very concrete interventions that we can do that can help, but no doctor is an island and no care setting functions on its own. And geriatric care is absolutely collaborative with nurses, social workers, case managers, and specialists in geriatrics to try and make the changes in care that are required.
Mm-hmm. Well, we appreciate what you're doing for the care of our older patients and in our community, and the way that we're able to, the way that you're really leading the nation and putting this forward and trying to figure it out and spread it to other institutions. Thank you for talking with us today and spending some time with us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
We've been talking with Dr. Kevin Bice of the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, Bob and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if you have a question you want us to address, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We've got some good questions today, Bob.
Yeah, we've got one on cockroaches, one on bumps from shaving, some stuff on headaches and fever and knot and migraine headaches.
All right, well, let's take our very first House Call question.
What do I do if I was bitten by a cockroach?
Well, that is sort of an easier question for us in that cockroaches, thankfully, don't bite. They are icky, and it sounds like you probably had one on your skin. And so I would say the first thing I would do is get it off of me and wash my skin wherever it touched, and then hopefully there's not a mark there.
Yeah, the thing we learn in medicine about cockroaches is that their droppings are associated with a lot of allergies and asthma in kids. So that, we do worry about them, but I've never heard anybody tell me they were bitten by one, and I actually pulled some literature, and while they list 10 sorts of insects that bite in the literature, cockroaches aren't among them.
So lots of other things that could have bitten you maybe the same day as the cockroach was on you. I do think it's important to try to avoid them, try to figure out where it's coming from and see if you can take steps in your household to reduce the cockroach burden.
Yes, sir, ma'am.
Yucky. Sorry you had to deal with that. Okay, let's take our next house call question.
I have small red bumps on my inner thigh along my hairline. They went away after 3 days of not shaving my bikini line. I feel fine, but I'm worried about what those bumps could have been and whether or not they will come back.
Well, I think what this is what's called folliculitis. In other words, the act of shaving one's face leads some people, in fact, not uncommonly, to develop inflammation of the hair follicles and little red bumps. And we call this folliculitis, and you see a lot of men who don't shave or wear a very short beard so that they don't have to shave because they always get folliculitis when they do. And the same phenomenon can happen in the axilla, the armpits, or the groin. And it sounds like this lady had it happen when she was trying to shave for her bathing suit. When she stops shaving, the problem goes away. So it's likely folliculitis.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Bob. And I'm glad to hear that it did get better without shaving. And it's sort of a pain. It's one of those things where there are other ways you could try to remove hair in that area through laser treatments or other things. But shaving may continue to cause this problem for you. I would also just back up, Bob, and say this could be something else, herpes, acne, some other problem. But the fact that it got better after he didn't shave is pretty telling. And I would agree with you. It sounds like folliculitis. Good luck to you, and I hope that these things stay away from you.
Yeah.
Let's take our next house call question.
I have a headache and had multiple tick bites this past summer. I don't feel sick other than the headache. Could it be Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain spotted fever?
A great question. And, you know, it's a complicated answer that we have to give you. You're talking about two different tick-borne illnesses being Lyme disease, which is not very common in North Carolina, or Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is more common in North Carolina and can make you really, really sick. Typically, that RMSF, or the Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which can still happen in the fall, it has a fever attached to it. So usually people are feeling pretty sick with that headache.
Yeah, it's a scary thing because it's got a mortality rate untreated that's pretty significant. And it can present with a whole lot of different kinds of signs and symptoms. But the thing that's universally true is patients who have Rocky Mountain spotted fever have a fever. And this person has some headaches, but not any other symptoms.
And could it be Lyme disease? Possibly, but again, with Lyme disease, you typically get additional symptoms as well. And headaches themselves can come from so many different things. So I'd encourage you to go and talk with your doctor about exactly when did you have the tick bites, when did you get the headache, what other factors are going on in your life, and see if together you guys can figure it out.
And the other thing to say about it is that you may have friends and relatives who live in Connecticut or New Jersey or somewhere where this is a much more common phenomenon. And lots of doctors there will treat their patients with antibiotics as long as they give any history of a tick bite with a deer tick and have any symptoms at all. Down in North Carolina, that's not as common. There are people who will prescribe 10 days of an antibiotic. The trouble is if this Lyme really gets established in a person, it can take months of antibiotics to make a difference. So most doctors would do some blood testing before they tried to do that.
All right. Well, hopefully that was helpful to you, and hopefully that headache is going away soon. Let's take our next household question, also about headaches.
What causes migraine headaches?
Well, that's an interesting and very complicated question. What causes migraine headaches? I remember when I started medical school in 1972, somebody told us in our medical school class what caused migraine headaches. And I'll tell you that every few years ever since, I've heard another theory about why migraine headaches occur. And I pulled the up-to-date quickie literature on it today and found this large catchphrase which says it's basically a neuronal syndrome. And while we know a lot about it, it's a headache, throbbing generally, often preceded by an aura or some neurologic set of symptoms that's unique. It throbs, it's unilateral and associated with nausea, vomiting, or worsening from sound or light. That is a migraine headache, but what causes it is a very different question.
I think one helpful question to ask is what causes your migraine headaches? And what I'm getting at are what are the things that bring it on or trigger it for you? There are lots of different factors that can play a part in this for different patients. It could be stress or your hormone cycles for women, changes in your diet or not eating enough during the day, weather, sleep problems, pain, alcohol, smoking, all kinds of different things can trigger it for people. And your job is to work with your doctor to figure out, well, what was it about today that was different that brought this headache on? What made it go away? And then the next time you get one, also write down, what was different? Did I sleep as much? Did I have the same amount of caffeine? What are those things? And then together you can come up with a plan to try to prevent those headaches.
It's interesting that 12% of the population does get migraine headache, and it's much more common in women than men. I would add only one more thing, which is that a lot of doctors will have a little list of foods that you can try to eliminate completely from your diet and then add them back and see if one of those precipitates it, because it's useful to know, and like 25% of migraineurs will have food precipitate their problem.
Well, thank you for the good questions today. We do need to do a whole show on migraine headaches and probably need time to do another one on tick-borne illnesses. But we did have a chance to also talk about bumps along hairlines and also a little bit about cockroaches, and they don't bite you. We're thankful for that. Thanks for joining us today, and we hope we've addressed some things that are important to you. We want you to share your questions. Email your stories at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our new health app.
We've been talking today with Dr. Kevin Bice of the UNC Department of Emergency Medicine about geriatric emergency care.
And I also want to thank you, Dr. Bob Gwyther, for being our guest host today. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we'll talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.